All right, we'll go ahead and get started. So, as I said, the Bible study today is going to be on the book of Ruth. So, how many, as you look at the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, how many sections is the Old Testament divided into? What are the three main divisions of the Old Testament? Does anybody remember? Yes. The Law, the Prophets, and the Writings. That's right. You could also say the Law, the Prophet, and the Psalms. So which section of the, which of those three sections is Ruth assigned to? The Law, the Prophets, or the Psalms, or Writings? Which, it's in the Writings. And as I said, that section is called the Psalms also. Do you know why it's called the Psalms? Because the book of Psalms is in the middle of that particular section and is the largest section, so they refer to it as a whole, as the Psalms. The books that are in the writings are Ruth, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Lamentations, and Daniel. All of those particular books make up the section of the Old Testament Hebrew Scriptures referred to as the Psalms or the Writings. So we're going to begin by looking at some background on the book of Ruth, first of all, in order to set the stage for what's coming. Believe it or not, there is a big lesson in the book of Ruth. You may think that this four-chapter little book, there's not much to it, but there's substantially more to the book of Ruth than you might realize. In fact, Ruth is a microcosm of God's church in certain ways. It tells us certain things about the church, and it is a way by which we can analyze what we've gone through historically in the church and sometimes what we go through even now. Now, the book of Ruth is set during the time of the judges. It's set during the time of the judges. We know that Israel came out of Egypt around 1440 B.C., and that may not be the exact year, but an approximate year. And the time of the judges runs from after Joshua on down to the time of King Saul assuming the throne. And that period of time would basically be from 1380 B.C. down to 1050 B.C. when Saul became king. And who was the last of the judges? Who was the last of the judges? Samuel? Okay, somebody mouthed Samuel. So, and who was the first of the prophets, official prophets? It was also Samuel. But Abraham was also a prophet. So there were prophets that predated Samuel, but Samuel was a prophet in the way that the others were, that would bring messages to Israel and seek to keep them on the right track. So the events in Ruth take place sometime earlier than Samuel. So Samuel is not the judge yet. It's a story of moral uprightness in contrast to the immorality during the time of the judges. So the time of the judges was a time when there was great morality in various parts of Israel, and it was also a time when you would find pockets of integrity and morality. And Ruth puts on display one of those pockets of morality. If you were to summarize conditions in Israel during the time of judges, how would you summarize that? How would you summarize general conditions in the land of Israel during the time of the judges? It's a verse that might summarize conditions. Yes, everybody did that which was right in their own eyes. And there's another part to that: there was no king in Israel. And so, there's no king, we can do what we want. All right? No king. We don't have to answer to anybody. We can do what we want. And that's still true. So when people, there's a breakdown of law and order in a city, and the police are no longer patrolling that section of the city, and somebody decides we're going to have a riot, what takes place? Everybody says, no police, nothing. It's a free run here, so we can take all the stuff we can get. And you see people hauling off TVs and all of that. And they're all thankful that we've gone to the flat screens and the lighter stuff, because some of those TV sets, you needed at least two or three guys to carry them off. So they had to get the portables or the little ones, the small TVs. Now you can get that big giant TV and it hardly weighs anything. So anyway, things have improved for the thieves, I guess. So anyway, there was no king in Israel, and therefore everyone did that which was right in their own eyes. And you see some horrible atrocities that take place during the time of the judges. And it wasn't all bad, but there were some difficult times. So with the book of Ruth, we get a glimpse into ancient Israelite culture. And it's a, in a sense, a case study of what it was like to live in a village or a rural setting. What was it like in Israel in that time? And you can get a pretty good picture of it when you look at what takes place in the book of Ruth. For example, you have the example of how a family at that time would deal with a famine. So what did you do when there was a famine? There's no food, so what are you going to do? If you stay here, you're going to die, so you had to leave. And that's what we find playing out in the book of Ruth. Elimelech, Naomi, and their sons, they moved from Bethlehem to Moab. And at this time, Israel was at peace with Moab, so they moved to Moab, and Moab was a cousin. They didn't act like it, or maybe they did act like it, because sometimes cousins don't get along. And there were times when that was definitely the case. But they moved to Moab because there was food there. There was no food in Israel, and life was became very tough. So they left their inheritance in Judah, and that had been handed out by Joshua under God's direction. So they had been given a section of land in the area of Bethlehem, and they left it behind and moved on to the land of Moab. And it's very possible that to have some seed money to go on to Moab, that they had sold the land, and therefore they had some money to survive on in Moab. The book of Ruth also gives us an account of the barley harvest, one of the main food grains. They had the barley and the wheat harvest. The wheat was probably a type of spelt. It probably wasn't wheat like we know it, but spelt, which is a variety of wheat. And they didn't have corn at that time, at least as we know it. We find in the story details of the threshing floor. How many of you have been around a threshing floor? We don't live in that time. Does threshing still take place here in the 21st century? It does. But how do they thresh grains in our time? A machine called a combine. So they're able to go through that field and cut down the wheat and process the whole thing, and it's threshed in the process and then blown out into the truck, you know, and so they have modern technology to do it. They don't do it the old-fashioned way, and we'll talk about that a little bit more as we go along. So Ruth also gives us an example of how a levirate marriage works. How many of you could explain what levirate marriage is? So, levirate marriage, it's the word levir, and levirate has that word levir in it. And the word levir has nothing to do with Levi, has nothing to do with him, and it has nothing to do with leverage. Not that, you know, somebody has a shotgun and placing leverage on you to get married. That's not what that's all about. So it describes what a levirate marriage is. Coming, as I said, it comes from the Hebrew word levir, and levir would be the husband's brother, the husband's brother. And Ruth ended up with a levirate marriage. There was no brother to Mary, but she did marry a close kinsman, as we'll see in the story. The book of Ruth also gives us some insight into the kinsman redeemer's role, redeeming the property of someone who died, the kinsman redeemer. And it shows how a kinsman could redeem the land if someone fell on hard times. Now, that's an ancient concept, but just as a question, do we have a kinsman redeemer? Do we, as God's people, have a kinsman redeemer? We do. His name is Jesus Christ. He is our redeemer. And isn't he our elder brother? He is our kinsman redeemer. And we'll see that in the context of Ruth. Ruth gives us an example of a transaction before the village elders at the city gate. So how did, if there was a court case, which is what takes place here in the book of Ruth, how is that handled? Where did they go? What did they do? And so we'll gain some insight into that. Now, who wrote the book of Ruth? Does anybody have a notion of who wrote the book of Ruth? Was it Ruth? Who wrote the book of Ruth? Traditionally, they say it was Samuel who wrote the book of Ruth. And interestingly, as you consider the book of Ruth, it's written from Naomi's perspective. It's written from Naomi's perspective. It's likely an oral tradition of Naomi that she had, from her experience, she had passed it on to her family, and it had been passed down, and eventually down in Samuel's time, he wrote down that tradition. There were additions during the time of David and Solomon to the book. Now, how do we know that? Well, let's just look at a couple of scriptures here. Let's go to Ruth chapter 4. Ruth chapter 4. Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, small book. Ruth chapter 4, verse 17. And you may be saying, why are you talking about this before Pentecost? What does this have to do with Pentecost? My wife and I were talking, Liz and I were talking about this on the way up here, and she said, well, it's traditionally read by the Jews at Pentecost. But that's not the reason that we're taking a look at it. There is a tie in here, which I think you'll see as we go on through the book. Verse 17, it says here in chapter 4, verse 17, also the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, there is a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed. There's a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed. Now, did Naomi have a child? She did not. Who had the child? Ruth. But it was attributed in a traditional way to Naomi. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Well, when this whole story unfolds, we have Naomi, we have Ruth, and we have Boaz. And as the story goes on, we don't see any evidence that Ruth's pregnant or anything like that, or that she has a child. But it's noted here in the scriptures, and they're looking not only to Obed, but to Jesse, and ultimately to David. So this was written down later, probably in Samuel's time, as Obed and Jesse and David came along. Let's go to look at verse 18. It says, now this is the genealogy of Perez. Who's Perez? Are we talking about a Mexican family that had moved up from, Mexico or another Spanish-speaking country? Is that what we're talking about? Who's Perez? Or Ferez is, sometimes is P-H. But who is? Does anybody know who that is? Yes. Steve? The son of Judah. He's one of the sons of Judah. So as you look at the genealogy here, Perez begot Hezron, and it goes through this whole genealogy, and you get down to Boaz, and so Boaz was of the family tree of Perez, and Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David. So David was from that particular side, the Perez side of the family. And but that was a descendant of Judah. And this family tree, it had to be written sometime later because none of this had unfolded yet. So there were some additions made, and God inspired those additions. Just because additions are made does not mean the book is bogus in some way. They're just filling in some information that is pertinent to the story and helps it to convey a larger message. Because the purpose of Ruth is to establish the origin of David. Where did he come from? Where is his family? Where did it come from? And ultimately, what's this looking to? Why tie it in with David? Why does that matter? Anybody have an idea why David is important? Yes. Yes, Christ, the Christ is to come from the line of David. He is the branch. He is the branch of David. And of Jesse that it talks about. And so Christ is descended from David. And as you'll see as you look, look at the Gospels, and you'll see that's very clearly pointed out by the Gospel writers. So additionally, we notice a comment in chapter 4, verse 7. Let's look at verse 7. It says, "Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging, to confirm anything, one man took off his sandal and gave it to another, and this was a confirmation in Israel." So he took off his sandal, and you give it to the person to whom you were giving the money. So this was the way it was set up in Israel. And so if you have a transaction, you sell a property, you have to take off your shoe and give it to the person who is giving you the money. So they're giving you money, you're giving him the shoe. Now why would you give him the shoe? Anybody know the answer to that? Why would you give him the shoe? What did that symbolize? I don't want your smelly shoe. I know you brought your worst shoes to the closet, and you're going to give me your smelly shoe. But they gave him the shoe. And the reason they gave him the shoe, the symbolism was that that person who had purchased the property now had the right to walk on that property. He now had the right to walk on that property, and giving of the shoe or the sandal was symbolic of that right to be able to walk on the property. Now the book has certain very important themes, and I'll just go through the themes, because as we look at the themes, as we come to the conclusions at the end of the study, then it'll help us in reaching those conclusions. One of the themes in the book is this, is that God will call all people to salvation. Nobody will be left out. This book reminds us that God will call all people to salvation. Nobody will be left out. Now, why would that be? How do you know that's a theme of the book? Anybody know? Why is that an important theme in the book? Let's think about Ruth. Was Ruth an Israelite? Ruth was what, from what country? Moab. She was from Moab. And when Naomi and Elimelech and the boys moved to Moab, Ruth knew nothing about the truth. She didn't learn about the truth until she came into the family of Elimelech. All right, so she didn't grow up with it. She was probably involved in the religion of the Moabites, which had abominable sides to it. And that's what she was used to. So God is going to leave no one out. He's going to call all to repentance. In fact, if you look at 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 9, it says, God is not willing that any should perish. He's not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And that is an overriding theme of the book of Ruth. And as you think about you know, that theme, the people of the Jews lost all sight of that. They lost all sight of God calling the Gentiles, and they were just completely opposed to God working through with the Gentiles. They just found that to be an abominable thing. Remember when Peter went out with to the house of Cornelius? They were astounded when God's Spirit was poured out on the house of Cornelius. But they should have known that this was coming because of what took place. I mean, one of the ancestors in Christ's line was a lady by the name of Rahab. And if I remember correctly, she was a Canaanite. All right? And then you have Ruth. So God's telling them, hey, fellas, you are my called out ones, but I love all people, and I call whom I will call. And my ultimate goal is to call all people and to add them to my family. So that one theme is God will call all people to salvation, and Ruth is a wonderful example of God's power to call any and everyone that he wants. Another theme is that we might title as loyal love. Loyal love. And we find that in Ruth's love for Naomi, which is famous, and the quote about Naomi and Ruth, where Ruth says, I'm going to stick with you, could also be called covenantal love. Love that keeps promises. And as you look at Ruth, Ruth had the integrity to keep her promises and maintain her family connection with Naomi. She had entered into a relationship with Naomi's son, and she entered into a relationship with Naomi. And that is the kind of love, and it is an example of the kind of love that God has for us. God has entered into a covenant. He loves us, not just because he made a commitment and it's his duty, but because God is love, God does love us, and he's committed to that. He is committed to that love, just as Ruth was committed to Naomi. Another theme is redemption. Redemption. God redeemed Ruth and Naomi from poverty by motivating Boaz, a close relative, to take them under his wing. He agreed to provide for them. He agreed to provide for them. And if you look at Boaz, Boaz was already doing quite well. Why take on Naomi? Why take on her daughter-in-law, Ruth? Why do that? He doesn't need to do that. He seems to be doing quite well. But he was willing to redeem them. He was willing to take them under his wing, to provide for them. And when Boaz married Ruth, he got Naomi in the package. So you get the daughter-in-law, and you get the mother. You get the whole package. And he was willing to take them on and to provide her for her throughout her life on into her old age. He was willing to take that responsibility on. And you see that Boaz had, you know, he wasn't gaining much from this in a way, and he was willing to take it on. And, you know, you see that he's willing to care for Ruth and her mother, Naomi, and make that commitment to them. It might be a good example for people living in our age, being willing to do that. And you know that as you take that on, there may be some sacrifice involved. We have the theme of the kinsman redeemer. The kinsman redeemer was a close relative with the means and resources to save a relative from slavery or poverty. So we have a kinsman redeemer who is a close relative with the means and resources to save a relative from slavery or poverty. And that's what Boaz did. He saved Naomi and Ruth from losing their ancestral land. And as I said, Christ is our kinsman redeemer. In fact, he's called our redeemer in the book of Galatians. He's called our redeemer in the book of Galatians. And as I said, we see an example, a theme of levirate marriage. which is another responsibility of a kinsman redeemer. In this case, he would take the impoverished widow to be his wife. He would take the impoverished widow, Ruth, to be his wife. And the first son born would be the heir of Ruth's first husband, Malon. So their first son would be the heir of Malon, not the heir of Boaz. So just something to, it's interesting. And we would find, now all of us would find that to be disgusting, all right, because that's not our culture. But having children and passing on the assets and things like that was a big deal in this age. And there was some way to try to keep this, because it could be a close kinsman. So it didn't have to be a brother. Well, there were probably no brothers, and therefore you had to have. So if you're going to perpetuate it in the family, this would have to take place. So this was a way to pass on assets and to pass on and to make sure houses were perpetuated. For instance, when God was able to adjust things as it didn't, you know, there weren't people to pass on the property to. There was a time in Israel when there were just daughters born to a man. And so how are you going to pass on his assets? Well, they came and said, well, how does this work for us? And they set up, okay, this is what God has said, this is how we'll proceed. And so they set up an organized way to make sure that inheritances were passed along properly. And so the land that Ruth controlled on behalf of the son born in the marriage would not go to her second husband, but to the son in the union. It would go to Obed. Obed would be the heir and was counted as the legal heir of the grandfather, Elimelech, and the son who had been married to Ruth, Mahlon, and who had died while they were in Moab. Now, let's quickly review the chapters here and just try to get the overview of things. We'll do a review, and this will help us as we analyze things at the end. So we know from Ruth chapter 1, that there was a famine in the land. There was a famine in the land, and so they had to leave the land. There was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. So they couldn't sustain life in Bethlehem, so they moved. And they went to where there was food, and then Elimelech died. So, you know, things, you know, you've moved and it's bad enough that you've had to leave your hometown and your assets behind. And you've found a place to live in Moab, and then the head of the household dies. So the two sons survive, and they married women from Moab. And one of the sons married a lady of Moab named Orpah, and Ruth married Mahlon. And then both sons died. So then you have Naomi and the two daughters-in-law. And Naomi eventually heard that the famine had ended and there was once again enough food in Israel. And we can move back to I can move back to my homeland because the famine is over there. So Naomi told the two daughters, you don't have to go with me. You can return to your father's houses. And you're still young enough that you can start a new life. You can find husbands and have children. And you don't have to come with me. And so she told her daughters to turn back. Turn back, my daughters. And you notice she doesn't call them daughters-in-law. She calls them her daughters. And as you look at Naomi, Naomi's not perfect, but she seems to be a very positive person, and she must have been a positive person, and following the laws of God, and been enough of a light to where Ruth saw that, and Ruth saw that God's way of life and action in Naomi's life, and she said, "This seems to be real. This is something that's worth pursuing, as opposed to pursuing my gods, the things that I'm used to." So she was a remarkable woman, probably a sterling example of God's way of life. Let's look at verse 11. Ruth 1, verse 11. Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Am I going to get married? I'm going to have more children? I've reached an age that's not going to happen. Turn back, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should bear sons, would you wait for them till they were grown? Are you going to wait all that time? For if I have children tonight for 9 months, are you going to wait?" She said, "Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." So she says, there are no sons. There's no hope of any sons, because if there were sons, then levirate marriage could take place and you could marry one of the sons. But that's not an option. That's not an option. And so that solution to the problem was not a possibility. So Orpah decided, "I'm going to go back to my father's house." So she kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her, it says. Ruth clung to her, and we have the famous quote beginning in chapter 1, verse 16, where Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you. Don't keep telling me to leave or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God." You stop and think about that. What a fantastic statement that is. Wouldn't you like to have a friend or somebody that you could count on that would go to this extent? "Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. And where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you from me." So I'm sticking with you, Naomi. I'm not going back to my family. And this is a very, you know, you've grown up in Moab. Moab is your home. This is where your father, your mother, your family lives. Your religion, your culture. And you're saying, "I'm giving all that up. And I am willing to go with you back to the land of Israel." That's a pretty profound severance from your own culture and background. And you think about that, that's what we are expected to do. That's the commitment that we're to make. The commitment that Ruth made. So Ruth had come to know of the true religion. Obviously through the family of Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion, and Naomi. She had seen their interactions and their way of living and obviously been impressed enough to say, "You know what? This seems real. This seems genuine. This is something that I would like to commit to." And you also have to realize God played a part in this. She didn't just do this on her own. God played a part in this, opening her mind to see the value of the way of life that Naomi had. So, she became a worshiper of the true God. She rejected the pagan gods of her homeland. She had reached a point where she was willing to change in her life and make a complete, abrupt change in her life and separate from her homeland. Now the God of Israel was her God, and therefore she was more than willing to go with Ruth or Naomi back to the land of Israel. Well, God was her God, and the people of Israel were her people. So Naomi tried to talk her out of it, but she would not be talked out of it, so they headed back to Israel and the land of Bethlehem. And as they return, you know, Naomi's been through a lot, losing her husband and her sons, and her life's had some tough turns at this point. And when she comes back to the land, they said, "Oh, Naomi's back in Bethlehem. And she said, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, which means bitter. So life had not gone well for her, and she was struggling with it. And you find God's people struggling with it at times. I mean, you look at Job. Job's life wasn't easy, and sometimes David's life and others in the faith, it wasn't easy. And it sometimes was tough. When they arrive back in Bethlehem, what time of the year is it? What time of the year is it? So it's, what's that? The harvest time, right. And they returned to the land, and they came back, and it was the harvest time. So which harvest was it? Barley harvest, okay. So when does the barley harvest start? It starts with the wave sheaf. So that's after the Passover. So if the barley harvest is still going on, it has to be between, it has to be after Passover and before Pentecost. Is that right? Okay. So you can see there's a very clear tie-in with Pentecost. So so we have this this harvest that has begun. They've obviously offered the wave sheaf, and the harvest is going on. So it has to be, as I said, between, it's after Passover and before Pentecost. And Pentecost is called the Feast of First Fruits, as we've seen. The Feast of First Fruits, that was the feast when the early harvest was completed. So it would be pretty well be completed by Pentecost, and the wheat harvest would also be ready to come in at that time as well. So they come back to Bethlehem. And what's interesting is you find that in Bethlehem, they're actually practicing some of these things that God laid out in the Scriptures. When you come into the land and you set up your society, this is how it's to be done. And they're actually practicing these things. Now, was it everywhere? No, there were a lot of people that were doing what was right in their own eyes. But you find a pocket of practicing God's religion here in Bethlehem. And so in that context, Ruth meets Boaz. So Naomi tells Ruth to go out and glean in the land. They don't have a crop. They don't have anything that they can harvest, but they can go out and glean. And that's something that God set up in Israel. It was common to the culture at that time. Let's go back to Deuteronomy and look at chapter 24. Deuteronomy chapter 24 and look at verse 19. Deuteronomy 24, verse 19. It says, when you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. So if you're harvesting wheat and some of it drops to the ground, just leave it. Don't go back and get it. Don't pick the field clean. It says, so if you forget a sheaf in the field, so a sheaf would actually be a whole bundle that you've gathered. You gather it up and then you cut it off. So it's more than just one stalk of grain. It's a bunch of stalks that you cut, and if you happen to drop it, just leave it. Because you've got the poor of the land that will come and take advantage of that. And God, that's what God set, the way God set it up. It says, you shall not go back to get it. He says, it shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the works of your hands. So I've set this up so that the poor can come and they can glean. And this was the way it was to be in Israel. They not only were, if they dropped something, they weren't to go back and pick it up, but what else were they not to do when they harvested their crops? They weren't to harvest the corners. They were to leave the corners of the field to also to be harvested by the poor. So God, as He's laying these things out for Israel, God made sure they understood that you're not just to be selfish and to gather everything up, but you're to think of other people And leaving the corners for the poor and the fatherless and all of that was how God set it up. And you can see God set up a society that was thoughtful and caring and was aware that people did have hard times and tried to make it possible for them to be taken care of. Let's go to verse 20. Let's go down to verse 20. It says, when you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. So when you harvested your trees, it was perfectly okay to shake on them and beat them to get the olives or whatever the fruit on the tree was to gather that. That was fine. But you weren't to just pick it clean. So you were to leave some for the poor. As it says here, verse 21, and when you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not glean it afterward. It shall be for the stranger and the fatherless and the widow. And you shall remember, you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this. Remember, life did not always go well for you. You had hard times, and you appreciated the blessings and benefits that I gave to you. So when I bless you with a harvest, you need to realize, look back to where you were at one time and think of other people, not just consider yourself. Leave some for the stranger, the widow, and the fatherless. So as they went out harvesting the grain harvest, they would go out and they would cut the grain. And as you're, you know, it was a bending over type of activity. And you had a hand side that you would use and you would bend down and you would get a bunch of grain, a sheaf of grain, and you would cut it off. And you would kind of put it together and wrap it up. I'm not exactly sure how they wrapped it up. And then you would stack it up with the stalks with the grain on it at the top and where you cut it off on the bottom. And you would put a bunch of these together standing up so they could breathe and they could continue to dry out and be ready for use in the future. And then eventually you would come around with a cart and load up all those sheaves. You know, we could sing Bringing in the Sheaves. You know, this is what they did. They went out, they got the sheaves, put them on the cart, and then they would take them to the threshing floor. And they would take them to the threshing floor, and they would cut off the heads of grain, and then they would have the oxen walk on the heads of grain. And they would walk around on them and stomp them, and with all that weight that an oxen has, it would tend to break up the shell of the grain itself, the head, and break the head and the shaft apart. And then on the threshing floor, they would have large baskets. They put the grain in a basket, and it's already been broken by the oxen. And usually where they would put the threshing floor, it would be up on a hill where there was a breeze commonly. And so they would take these baskets, and they would throw the grain up in the air, and as the breeze would come through the threshing floor, it would blow out all of the chaff and leave behind the grain. So they would throw it up, and the wind would blow through it and blow out the chaff, and then they would just have the grain left. So all of this is, you think about it, it was labor-intensive. And you were bending over and cutting it, and you were stacking it and loading it and taking it in and getting the oxen to walk over it, walk around on it, and break it up, and then you were threshing it. So that's all physical labor that you were involved in. But it was hard work, but it was also a special time. I know that, I think of my family, and I never did this, so I always felt sorry for my cousins who had to work in the garden, because I didn't have a garden, so I didn't have to go out and hoe and pick weeds and all this. And I thought, you poor devils. And I'd be playing, and I said, well, when you get done with that, let's do this. And so, looking back at that now, they probably hated me. Man, he gets out of it. You ought to come and help us. And believe me, I never offered to help, which they probably remember to this day. But anyway, I probably should have, but I was not very mature then. I was just looking at the fact I didn't have to do it. So they talk about how this harvest of grain is to take place and to consider others. Let's go on to chapter 25, which points up something else. Let's look at verses 5 through 10. Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 through 10. It says, if brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. So you are to keep it within the family. Her husband's brother shall go in to her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of his dead brother, and his name may not be blotted out of Israel. But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. But if he stands firm and says, I do not want to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and answer and say, so it shall be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal removed. So I don't think that was a title you wanted to have, you know, if you could avoid it. Oh, you're that guy, huh? And as you'll see, as this plays out, Ruth does, you know, there's no spitting in the face that takes place there. So that may have taken place in some circumstances, but it did not does not play out in what we see here with Ruth and Boaz. So Ruth goes out to glean. She goes out to glean, and she ends up in the field of Boaz. Now, how do you think it came that she ended up in the field of Boaz? Yes? They were all from Bethlehem, and one field kind of butted up against another, you know. So they knew where their field started and ended, but as the harvest is taking place, you didn't, oh, this is Boaz's. She didn't pick a field and with a purpose. I know this is Boaz's field. She didn't do that. She just went out to glean. Here's a place where I can glean, and she began gleaning. It just happened to be Boaz's field, which was a fortuitous event that I'm sure God had played a hand in. So Boaz comes out to inspect his field in the story and inquired about Ruth. Who's this? Who's this young lady? And he's told she was the daughter-in-law of Naomi. So Boaz tells Ruth, look, just go ahead and... you know, he recognized who Naomi was. Naomi was a close relative, and he said, glean in my field, stay close to my women, and I will command the young men not to touch you. And so she replies to Boaz, why have I found favor in your eyes? Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner? Why would you treat me in this positive way when I am from Moab? I'm not an Israelite. I'm not an Israelite. Let's look at something about Ruth here in verses, chapter 2 of Ruth, and verses 11 and 12. Verses 11 and 12 of Ruth 2. It says, and Boaz answered and said to her, if it has been reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how much you have left... and how you have left your father and mother and the land of your birth and have come to a people whom you did not know before. The Lord repay your work and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. And so he recognizes, he's heard about Ruth and her example that didn't just begin when they came back to the land of Israel, but began in the household of Naomi in the land of Moab. He's heard about this. Ruth has obviously talked positively about Ruth, and he's heard about it. And now he just relays back what he's heard about her, which is very positive. So Ruth is a very positive and special person. And look at how she replies to Boaz in verse 13. Then she said, let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and have spoken kindly to your maidservant. Though I am not like one of your maidservants, you've accepted me as one of your maidservants, one of Israel. She doesn't see herself as a foreigner. She feels accepted. So Boaz then tells his the young men working at his field, he says, look, when you continue the harvest and you're gathering the sheaves, make sure you just let some extra stuff go. Let some extra stuff fall to the ground. Be sloppy in what you do. So that day they harvested an ephah, which in comparison to a bushel is about 31 pounds of grain. About 31 pounds of grain is what she took home. And how did she transport it home? She filled her pockets? No. What they did is they put it in a jar and you put it on your head. So she had 31 pounds of grain and walked home with it. Now, people living in that time had some real neck muscles. Because you see ladies, you know, in the Middle East and places carrying all kinds of things on their head. We don't do that. But they did it in that particular time. So she hauled the grain home on her head. And then and she tells Naomi about her good fortune, that things worked out positively, and Naomi hatches a plot. So knowing the levirate marriage responsibility and that Boaz was a close relative, she tells Naomi or Ruth what to do. God's truths about gleaning and about levirate marriage are being maintained here. And Ruth is to stay with Boaz's harvesters right on up until close to Pentecost. And at the end of the harvest, finishing up the winnowing of the barley, she was to clean up, put on her finest clothes, and go down to the threshing floor. And she said to notice where he goes to sleep. Notice where he goes to sleep. And Boaz went to sleep on the top of his barley. So he's laying there on the barley, on the ground, and Naomi told Ruth to lie down at his feet. Now, why did she say lie down at his feet? Why do that? So, yes. Put protection and it's submission. I'm willing to submit to you and ask that you would intervene to redeem me. So in the middle of the night, Boaz recognized someone at his feet. And there's nothing sexual here. You know, we would all read sex into it living in the 21st century. But there's nothing sexual going on here. She submits to him and what he was to do when this was undertaken was he was to cover her with his robe, indicating that he would take her under his wing. And so he says, take your maidservant under your wing. She's saying, I want you to marry me and perform the levirate responsibility for my late husband alone. He tells her there is one, and Boaz replies, well, I'm happy to do that, but there's one closer who's a closer relative than me. And so I'll approach him tomorrow, and if he says I'll fulfill this responsibility, then that's it for me. But if he won't, then I will be happy to redeem you and do what you've requested. We'll let God decide it. So let's go to chapter 4. And it says in chapter 4, verse 1, now Boaz went up to the gate. This is where court cases were decided. It would be like going to the courthouse, but this is the way it was in ancient times. You went to the gate where the elders would come. So they went to the courthouse of the time and sat down there, and behold, the close relative of whom Boaz had spoken came by. And so Boaz said, come aside, friend. And it's interesting as you look in, it's called, the word there in the Hebrew is poloni almoni. And one person's explanation of that was, hey, so-and-so, and is how he refers to this guy. And so poloni almoni meant that very thing. So he said, hey, friend, sit down here. So he came aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down. So they sat down, and then they laid out the case, talking about Naomi, who had come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech, And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants and the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am next after you. And what does he say? I will redeem it. And why is he going to redeem it? It's because he loves Naomi and Ruth and it really cares for them? No. He's going to redeem it because it's going to enhance his property and his riches. So he tells him, okay, he says, I'll redeem it, but he doesn't have the whole picture. So Boaz gives him the whole picture and he said, you know, in the day that you redeem it, you're going to have Naomi and you're going to have to take Ruth as a wife. What? That's not quite as lucrative as the first offering there. That's more to the story, and I don't really want to invest in that. And he said, because it's important that we perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. And the close relative said, I cannot redeem it for myself lest I ruin my own inheritance. You redeem my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it. So he was unwilling to do it. He was unwilling to take on that responsibility. So the way was open for Boaz to redeem the property and to perform levirate marriage as a kinsman redeemer for Ruth and marry her. So that's the story. Now let's look at some lessons as we come to a conclusion. First of all, as you look at this, and the first lesson is this. When we look at the Old Testament, we have the Old and the New. And we can compare the Old Testament to the New Testament, and we should, because there are correlations between the Old and New that help us to understand the meaning more clearly. We compare ancient Israel to the Church of God. And there is a correlation. Because Israel walked in the wilderness, and who was the rock that was with them? That rock was Christ. And as you look at Stephen, as he was talking to the people of his time, and he was giving his great speech before his death, he called Israel the church in the wilderness in Acts 7, verse 38. The church in the wilderness. And it corresponds to the spiritual church of God today. The key lesson, there was a physical Israel, and there still is, and there is a spiritual Israel, the church. A spiritual Israel, the church. For instance, you look in Galatians chapter 6, verse 16, what is it called, the church? Anybody remember? The Israel of God. It is the Israel of God. And as you look in the New Testament, you look in Hebrews 11, which is the faith chapter. And all of the examples there are taken from what? They're all New Testament examples, aren't they? In Hebrews 11, the faith chapter? No, every last one of them is from the Old Testament. But they were recorded by the Apostle Paul for all of us, the church. And we gain insight and understanding and encouragement for all of those examples. And Ruth, as I said at the outset, was a microcosm of God's church historically as well as the church today. Let's look at a few examples. As you think about the church, some are born into the church. In the story of Ruth, you have Naomi, Boaz, Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion, all born into the church in the wilderness, or the church in the land of Israel at that time. But they were all born into it, just as we have individuals born into the church at this time. But Ruth, she wasn't a part of Israel at all. And she was added. She came out of the world. And both those who were born into the church and both of those who come from outside the church into it, all of them can and must equally become dedicated to following God, whether they were born in the church or called from without the church. So there was an underlying culture in the time of the judges, which was God's truth. We see an example of that in the city of Bethlehem. We find levirate marriage, the gleaning, the land transaction. There was a core of God's law that was being followed. And that's what we find in the church today. A core of God's truth, God's law, being followed in the church today. The church is the pillar and ground of God's truth. We find they weren't following God's law perfectly. There were areas where they weren't following it at all. They weren't following it at all. Look at what took place in Benjamin with the concubine of the Levite. It's horrendous what took place there. And then the slaughter after that. So God's way or God's truth is found in His church. It's not found in society. The society around us has bits and pieces of the truth, but they have no clue about the overall package, and they especially don't understand at this point in time the plan of salvation. There will come a day when everyone will understand, but that's not the case at this particular time. So we can't compare God's church to the religions common to the world. The true religion and the religions of the world are dramatically different. And Ruth came to recognize that difference in her time. And she, with God's help, came to see it and respond to it and to become a part of Israel and to become a part of the very lineage of Jesus Christ. Let's go to Acts chapter 20. Acts chapter 20. And this ties in with the close relative that refused the opportunity to perform the levirate marriage. He was the so-and-so, the as it expresses there in Ruth, he was more interested in his own well-being. As you look at chapter 20, verse 17, it says, "For from Miletus he sent to Ephesus and called for the elders of the church. And when they had come to him, he said to them, 'You know from the first day that I came to Asia, in what manner I always lived among you, serving the Lord with all humility, with many tears and trials which happened to me by the plotting of the Jews. How I kept back nothing that was helpful, but proclaimed it to you and taught you publicly and from house to house.'" So he's telling them his experience with them in the city of Ephesus, talking to the elders about how he served in the church. Let's go down to verses 29 and 30, where he warns them. He warns them and he says, "For I know this, that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock." And that very thing, he warned them, and that did happen. Verse 30, "Also from among yourselves men will rise up speaking perverse things to draw away the disciples after themselves." There will be people that will come along and their interest is in themselves. They're not willing to serve. They're not willing to give. They're not Boazes. They're like the other relative who said, "I don't want to take on that responsibility." Now, he was not a ravening wolf, but he was more interested in his own well-being, not in doing his duty to the house of Elimelech. Let's go to 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2. We will end shortly. So if you're looking at your watch, I saw some people tapping their watches. It'll be giving me the T sign and all that. So anyway, chapter 2, verse 1, it says, "But there were also false prophets among the people." So there were false prophets in ancient Israel, ravaging wolves. "And there were, even as there will be, false teachers among you." They were in ancient Israel, they were in the church, and they are still in the church, unfortunately, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. So we have to watch out for that. and be aware of it. We want to be faithful and dedicated like Naomi, Boaz, and Ruth. The final point, where you go, I will go. Where you will go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. That's what Ruth said to Naomi. And since we're in Peter, let's go to 1 Peter 2 and look at verses 9 and 10. 1 Peter 2, verses 9 and 10. It says, but you are a chosen generation. That's what the church of God is. That's what God's people are, a chosen generation. A royal priesthood, potential members of the family of God, potentially going to serve as kings and priests in the future. A holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Who once were not a people. Who was in that state that we've looked at in the story here? Who was not part of the people of God? Ruth. Who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. See, Elimelech, Naomi, Mahlon, and Chilion were all born into it. Boaz was born into it. Ruth had no idea. But God, in his mercy, opened up a panorama that she had not seen before. And she found it so appealing and presented in such a positive way, and with God's mercy and God's intervention, she turned to God and became a part of it. You know, we weren't a people and we didn't even know each other, but now we do. That's the interesting thing. And we'll, you know, we did not choose each other. God chose us and God brought us together. We're here in Houston or wherever we happen to gather because God brought us together. We didn't choose each other. God said, okay, I brought you together. Let's see what you can do with it. So, God calls all mankind ultimately, and the church, which is the agency of his calling, and we are part of the church. There's a continuum between the Old Testament and the New, the physical and the spiritual, from the church in the wilderness to the church of God. And as you look at what Peter has to say, let's go to chapter 4 and look at verses 3 and 4. Chapter 4, verse 3. It says, for we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles. Isn't that where Ruth came from? She came from a Gentile society. She came from a Gentile society. When we walked in lewdness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. You might think about, well, why mention these things? Why mention these things? What are the Gentiles doing that for? The reason is because all of these things are common to pagan religion. They're all common to pagan religion, the doctrines of paganism. It's how they worshipped their gods and goddesses. And that's why pagan religion was so powerful and had such a pull sexually and emotionally on the church. Even in Peter and Paul's day, it was all around them. It like an addiction in the society, and we have a similar society today. And as you see the society becoming more crude, more lewd, more vulgar, more open in their displays of sexuality, that is a move back toward paganism. That is paganism. But you're accepting it more and more and more. And that was the society that Ruth came out of. That was common in her society. But she was moving to a society where that was rejected and was not acceptable. And that's a society that we've come out of and come into the truth. We are a chosen generation in God's church today, and just like ancient Israel was a chosen generation in their time. A people who weren't a people before the church, And many of us were part of the world. We were part of the religion of the world. And we're no longer a part of it. But God has opened our minds to see something bigger and greater that He's working out here below. Ruth recognized that relationship that predated the spiritual church. And she is one of the ones who will be in the first resurrection. One of the few who were called out of physical Israel to be converted. The lesson of Ruth is still powerful today. God wants people to become His people. Ruth chose to leave her culture, her society, her family, and become a follower of God. And let's all do the same. So thank you for your attention. Sorry to go over 10 minutes, but please have a wonderful remainder of the afternoon. Have a safe journey home.